The Eastern Cape is one of South Africa's more troubled provinces. Historically, an amalgamation of the old Cape administration and then two apartheid-era Bantustans, the Ciskei and the Transkei. It's produced an administration in the contemporary period, which is especially prone to corruption, serious service delivery problems, and in the context of COVID-19, some of the worst institutional crises around health provision, around the collapse of hospitals, etc. From our purposes for today, local government in the Eastern Cape is especially troubled, but also the perspective from local government provides a very interesting insight, perhaps a microcosm, of how governance is working in South Africa as a whole.
Welcome to Filling the Gap, a podcast about government and potentially how to fix it. Dr. Ivor Chipkin is one of the country's best social scientists. He is the founder of the Public Affairs Research Institute at Wits University, and today he runs South Africa's first global think tank on government, GAP. He's the author of two books on government and one of the country's deepest thinkers on government and how to fix it.
We don't have a capacity problem in this country. We have a problem of intention. So the people that were being appointed into this administration were capacitated in a very particular way. They were capacitated in order to process certain transactions, and they just didn't, quite frankly, care about a lot of their core service delivery functions.
That's the voice of Dr. Crispian Olver. He was the Director General for the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. That's when I first met him. But before that, the medical doctor was a well-known political activist in the Eastern Cape. He helped draft some of the legislation we're talking about today and has held numerous high-profile roles in government. In 2002, he coordinated the hosting of the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg. He's now an academic and author of two books about local government and how they go wrong, sometimes quite dramatically. His book, How to Steal a City, published in 2017, is a gripping insider's account of the corruption in Nelson Mandela Bay, formerly known as Port Elizabeth. It lays bare how the administration was entirely captured and bled dry by a criminal syndicate, and how factional politics within the ruling party abetted that corruption. Crispin was also there when local government legislation was written, and has first-hand knowledge of why so much power was devolved down to the lowest level of government. And he knows what went wrong. We'll be joined later by Professor Mbisi Ndletshana from the University of Johannesburg.
I was part of the original team of policy wonks inside the ANC that were pushing very hard for local government to be given independent constitutional powers and protections. And it was all part of a push at the time for what we call developmental local government. So we had this idea that local government is where government's closest to the people, and it's where the real development stuff happens, and you want to put fiscal policy and resources down into the hands of local authorities so that they can drive change and make it happen. At the time, we didn't really think too much about what happens when things go very wrong. So a lot of effort was put into protecting the constitutional status and powers and functions of local government. And we created, you know, de novo, this wall-to-wall local government system, sometimes in places where there'd never been local government before. And even where there was local government, we were coming from a very racially divided, institutionally split kind of local government that didn't really work in the new South Africa. So, you know, I think the original drafters, and I, you know, take blame partly on myself for this, were naive in not thinking through carefully how things go wrong, what to do when local government fails, and what checks and balances to put in place.
So, Crispin, of course, that's how I was one of those naive people. That's how I think you and I first met. That was many, many years ago. I was a lightie, and I'd been brought in with Tapisa Maswanini to write the white paper on local government. And I think you were the DG at the time. I remember some very stressful meetings with Praveen Gordon at Gordon in those days. But you were heavily involved, and I think there was a tremendous naivety in writing that document. And as I recall it, there were those fierce debates around developmental local government and what its particular characteristics were in relationship to the private sector. But really what animated all of us, I think, was a deep sense that real democratic momentum lay in local government. After all, the revolt that had brought apartheid down in the 1980s was largely an urban revolt. It was largely or substantially driven by local government issues. So there was a sense that the real democratic momentum in South Africa came from the local. And I think, I was thinking that the autonomy of local government was designed to protect that area of democratic momentum or that space of democratic mobilization. That was certainly how I was thinking about it. And of course, I think you're absolutely right. We never not for many moments, did we think of things going terribly wrong other than in relationship to traditional government. And I mean, that was the great preoccupation. So if you look at the white paper on local government, we steered far away from dealing with traditional government because we thought that was going to be the area of where things might go wrong. The reason I wanted to have this conversation, and I hope BC is able to join us, because after all, we have one of these really fortunate serendipitous moments where we've got two books on the same subject coming out by two really astonishing and accomplished writers, scholars, activists. One by Mobisi Mletshana, who's one of South Africa's great political scientists, and of course by Crispian Olver, by yourself. Both on Nelson Mandela City, both on PE, both in a similar time frame. And I'm hoping we could have a conversation. Why I think that conversation on municipalities is so important currently, because it seems to me your book shed light on what is South Africa's currently, I believe, the most acute question being posed. And that is, why is it so difficult to execute policy? So we now currently are sitting with two major economic plans, one from the presidency, one from business, amazingly or strangely alike in all in key areas around growth through large-scale infrastructure development. There's some difference around how you finance this. So around the planning, there seems to be lots of consensus around what we need to do. But what our record is in terms of doing things, well, that's an altogether different story. Now, it seems to me that your experience and to some extent my experience, I think, is an opportunity to start raising questions about why it's been so difficult in South Africa to move from plan to execution. And that's really what I'd like to discuss in today's session with you.
The political party in power in Nelson Mandela Bay was the ANC. And they'd been in power there since the dawn of democracy. The metro had been created in the year 2000, bringing together Uitenhage and a number of the sort of far-flung townships in PE. So there's this large metro authority created. And initially it functions really well. You got the first black mayor, Neba Faku. He's a sort of strong regional leader. He's quite visionary. He's got this 2020 plan for the city with a whole lot of spatial development areas. He wants to remake the harbor and reconfigure the freeways and bring development into a whole lot of nodes around the city. But what's happening in the ANC is that it becomes increasingly factionalized. And it's, I suppose, part of a broader countrywide trend where to get ahead in the ANC, for a political leader to emerge and succeed, you've got to be able to build a following. You need loyalty. And that loyalty has to be bought. You need to bring resources to the table that enable people to organize, to get airtime, to get t-shirts and banners. And those resources are few and far between. You know, we often didn't really think about how political parties are meant to be funding themselves. Nationally, they're, you know, large corporates with deep pockets that do back political parties for particular reasons. But in a sort of the Eastern Cape backwater, most of these are small or medium-sized businesses, and they're wanting to do deals. They're not going to give money for nothing. So they want promises of favors and contracts. And for political leaders that, you know, aren't adept at navigating this thing, they get slowly sucked into a whole range of deals and promises and backhanders, some of which, you know, they use for organizing, and often some of it they use for advancing themselves or, you know, accumulating their own wealth. So there's this interplay between resources and power, and it inevitably washes into the state. And what starts to happen from about 2007 is you get an increasing factionalization, and it's linked into battles that start to take place between Thabo Mbeki nationally and Jacob Zuma. When I came into PE, there were at least three different factions, the most prominent of which had this endearing name of the Stalini faction. That was the group that Nebafaku was attached to.
In case you think communists invaded a small province in a windy city, it's actually the name of a public hall where people used to meet socially called Estalini. It means a stable.
They used the local state as a piggy bank. Essentially saw all these big infrastructure programs as sources of rent and established political control over the machinery of the local state in order to channel resources back into their political base and to build their political followings.
What I enjoyed so much about your book was that the Stalini faction wasn't just a bunch of people pursuing self-enrichment. They were pursuing what they understood, according to you, as a program of radical transformation within the city itself. The fact that some of them became very wealthy doesn't detract from the fact that there was a genuine political ambition behind their operations. So I'm fascinated in these narratives. You know very, very well that in the course of the work that I was doing on state capture in the Betrayal of the Promise report, we argued, and we took a lot of flack for it, but I stand by that argument, that state capture wasn't simply driven by looting and corruption, that those involved, including President Zuma, weren't just motivated by greed and self-enrichment, but rather they were seeking, I think, in good faith, I've made that point many times, in good faith, a political program of radical economic transformation, using the state and enterprises to disrupt the existing structure of the economy and create space for new black-owned and black-empowered enterprises. So what I've always argued, and I think you're saying something similar, is that self-enrichment and a political program are not mutually exclusive, and one has to think of the relationship between the two. And it seems to me that that relationship sits uncomfortably with the current discourse in South Africa, which has become especially strong in the last 18 months or 2 years, around that essentially what we're dealing with in state capture or with the South African history, even going back into the apartheid period, is essentially one long history of shocking corruption. So what's your sense of that?
Sure. So I completely get the point you're making about ideology. And I think it's fascinating the way, you know, for members of a faction, they believe fervently in what they're doing. So the narrative that people tell themselves is internally coherent. They, you know, it makes sense to them and it directs their actions. But we obviously need to be critical of that narrative. For me, the very stark element was that while Stalini believed in, or the narrative they peddled was one of transformation and development and bringing town and township closer together, what they were doing was extracting too much out of these programs for them to be able to deliver anything substantively. So the bus rapid transit system, which was key to bringing township residents closer, you know, in terms of space and commuting time, never got underway while the ANC was in power. It was only when the DA came in with their coalition that they finally got a portion of the BRT system running. And the real quest for Stalini was a quest for power. I think we've got to accept that the ideology that they had was, in a sense, a fig leaf for underlying what there was, which was a hunger for power and a hunger for resources to sustain that power. And it seemed to me as a sort of self-defeating pursuit.
Except that this idea of pure raw power, I think, is unlikely. Almost certainly, all pursuit of power, even corrupt power, needs to be somehow justified politically. This is one of the key arguments of Piketty's new book, for example, and his notion of an inequality regime. Ultimately, all forms of inequality, all forms of wealth distribution need somehow to be politically justified. And therefore, that political justification essentially requires ideology. I think that ideological aspect is often what is missing in South African conversations about corruption and about theft of public resources, for example. And I think it's one of the key areas which I'd like to discuss more fully in the course of this podcast. How is corruption, how is inequality justified in the South African context? We are very lucky to also be joined by Professor Mbisi Mhlatshana, whose new book, The Anatomy of the ANC in Power, also focusing on Nelson Mandela, and covers more academically very much of the same ground that was covered in Chippy's book. Professor Mhlatshana also investigates wholesale corruption in the Eastern Cape. He is currently a professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Johannesburg. And many of you will know him also for his very public role as a public intellectual, both on TV and in print. Obviously, great to have you on board.
The book is really, it covers a 29-year-long period, beginning in roughly late 1989 to 2019. Mainly looking at the decline, what accounts for the decline? And obviously, to understand the decline, one needs to understand how the ANC was at that point of re-establishment. You kind of look at the structures, how these structures were established. What was the attraction to the ANC? What were the traditions of the ANC that were resumed after 1990? And once you look at that, especially between 1990 and 94, you see the decline as there's a level of inevitability to the decline of the ANC, because, it attracts almost everybody. And this is the story about liberation movements, big parties, that at some point you have these factions, along different, interests. Because it's a liberation movement that attracts everybody. So the very thing that makes it popular, meaning a liberation movement, also in a way creates the seeds, so to speak, of its own destruction. And that's what would happen to the ANC with all these contending factions, some less committed to the ideas of the organization than others. But the critical thing, I think, just two last points on this, is one, it's not sufficient to decry corruption, and I think everyone, disapproves of corruption. But the idea is to understand how does it start and what makes it normal and thereby difficult to uproot. And the problem here has to do with the legislative framework and institutions. In that, in 95, in fact, beginning with the TLC in May of 94, the new councillors inherit apartheid legislation, which, allowed councillors to serve on tender committees and award tenders to themselves to set up companies and bid for work. So this is an old apartheid legislation because local government legislation at the time had not been transformed. You didn't have new legislation. So you have, and this thing gains momentum after 95 elections. So you have all these councillors, pretty much each has his own company. And the temptation to do that was quite great, because at the time they only got stipends. They didn't really have serious salaries. And their offices, their positions allowed for it. So they become entrenched in business practices. Of course, the law changes after 2000 with the introduction of Structural Act and Systems Act and MFMA, which creates a clear division between administrative and political functions. But these folks have become so entrenched in business that they now shift the focus, because they are no longer part of tender committees, which meant that they could not influence the award of tenders. They then redirect their focus towards influencing the choice of managers, because if you have your manager, it then means that that manager will influence these tenders in your favor. So the fight that you subsequently see, especially when MFA was fully implemented after 2004, that instability over city manager, executive directors has to do with councillors fighting over who should be manager, because whoever has a manager there is guaranteed of tenders. So it's failure initially of legislation to regulate and determine proper behavior for these new institutions. So there was a lacuna there that was exploited and then evolved into practices with vested interest. So when legislation was already in, it then became difficult to change because they had become accustomed to this practice. And the second thing on this one last point is the party, right? I think one has to understand that institutions are made up of individuals, and at times individuals have their own interests that may not necessarily be aligned to the organization. So the extent to which an organization is able to function well depends on how well it enforces its rules. I mean, that is why there's a difference between an organization and an institution. An institution is far more evolved than an organization, with clear set of rules, habitual behavior, everything is accepted and complied with as second nature. With the ANC, right, you have a strong character like Nneba Faku. By the way, who was supported by the Communist Party, because Nneba Faku, as a national figure, as a national organizer, he could not contest office. So he came in as an SACP candidate, interestingly, from 94, right? So Nneba is this strong personality, believes quite highly so in his abilities, and has little respect for people who don't read or don't seem to know much. And so he becomes somewhat autocratic, takes unilateral decisions without consulting caucus and this and that. So then in that case, obviously the responsibility falls on the leadership of the party to rein in his excesses. But the party itself fails to do that because they are in awe of Nneba. They didn't think that there was anyone who could do the same or better Giraffe's performance, right? And at the time, interestingly, especially in 1998-95, Maxakwana was provincial secretary of the ANC. They knew that Nneba was prone to this autocratic behavior, but they actually liked it, because they felt that the ANC needed to fast-track transformation. And especially at that time, you were going to have a merger in 2000 of UDNH and Dispatch into a metro. So they needed someone quite forceful, actually, a forceful figure to lead that merger and fast-track transformation in PE. So Nneba, even though the ANC says it's a democratic organization, at the same time, they quite liked his strong arm tendencies, because they were also critical of the long consultative processes in the ANC. So preferred this strong man figure. So you have tension there evolving. So in closing here on this point is that you have the ANC never quite adapted into being a party in government. Providing leadership, developing ways of dealing, creating sufficient or effective coordination between headquarters and government, and most importantly, ensuring that you are able to rein in strong figures who have the propensity to veer off party policies.
Crispin, do you want to respond to that? Because it seems to me that there's a tension between what there's a tension in the book with regard to that around this question of what we might call ideology. What strikes me around about your presentation, obviously, which is completely fascinating, and I mean, I haven't finished the book, but I'm working through it, is what happened to the idealism of activists, etc., from in an earlier period. I mean, their transformation into what you call unscrupulous individuals seems to be so absolute and so rapid that it's a little bit bewildering, one is struck by the kind of depravity of it all, and that's the sense that I'm getting from your analysis. So, what has happened to that deep sense of idealism, that deep commitment to a politics of transformation, of liberation, of a politics of democratization, of non-racialism, etc.? Was that all in Crispin's terms earlier? Was that just a fig leaf for crass accumulation?
No, I think the party. Obviously, there was that commitment, but I think the offering of government, the layer of material benefits, I think got the better of them, especially because you did not have a strong monitoring kind of function, kind of a vanguard element to it, to ensure that leaders stick to parties' values. And for instance, they developed a code of conduct, but that code of conduct was never implemented. And partly, Ivo, the main issue, I think the problem here was the co-option of the ANC by and large into government processes. So because the party was meant to remain quite strong outside as a monitoring coordinating body. And this is what Thabo Mbeki talked about in a discussion judgment towards December 94 conference, that you need to have party remaining outside quite strong to exercise oversight and ensure that people abide or follow ANC values and comply with ANC policies. But all these headquarters, from national, provincial, to even to Standard House, were quite weak. If you look at Mbeki's NWC, for instance, most of them were ministers. Lutuli House was left, or Shell House at the time, was left pretty much empty. The same applied with Tsalata House, provincial house in PE. It was quite weak. The REC in the old Cape then was even worse, because you, at the time also, you didn't have the moral influence of Govan Mbeki, who was part of that. Omrei as well were part of that REC, right? So everybody is consumed with government and the opportunities that are offered by government. And I mean, you have folks here who didn't have salaries, frankly. And the fact that it was allowed by law. This is the thing. It's allowed by law for them to form companies. So this is legitimate business. But it started off as legitimate, but it then, and also as a way of making extra income, but they then get drawn into these businesses to a point where you have a serious fallout in 1999. For instance, the plot where you have the boardwalk complex now in the waterfront where it's built, there was a huge fight in the ANC in 99 over two factions that owned parts of that plot in the waterfront. And the whole issue was that each faction in the ANC was using its own influence in government to enable it to buy the plot. Right. So this business interest in the ANC become so entrenched, and it creates a precedent, that gets followed up even after 2000. Then you have this thing that is our turn now to, but the point is that the party is never able to exercise its moral influence over its deployees because government just took over.
Might I say that? I mean, I think, BC, that what you're saying is pretty much a microcosm or perhaps a macrocosm of what's happened all throughout South Africa, and that this one very detailed example of how all of this governance broke down from apartheid era legislation, stipends instead of salaries, entrenched factions fighting amongst each other for ideological beliefs, in a way that kind of sums up the state of politics in South Africa, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, no, it does. I mean, that's what has become, the violent part of our politics now is even more pronounced in KZN. So you see this, I think, playing out everywhere. Yeah, you're quite right.
Yeah, just to come in on that, I mean, the capacity issues in local government and particularly as we encountered them in Port Elizabeth are very revealing, because it's not just that the municipality's capacity has been deliberately weakened. It's capacitated in a different way. So, Mkabisi talked about this controlling of the appointment of aligned managers. And I came up against this, management team appointed by the Stalini faction, who were, I must tell you, extremely capable at processing certain transactions. There's this, a brilliant transaction. In fact, it's written up in the Piccoli forensic report, where they process a really complex payment for the bus rapid transit system that would ordinarily take a month, all the way through procurement and legal and through the technical evaluations and all the way through to budget and treasury and then ultimately payment. They do all of that in 24 hours. Which, you know, I've used as an example to say we don't have a capacity problem in this country. We have a problem of intention. So the people that were being appointed into this administration were capacitated in a very particular way. They were capacitated in order to process certain transactions. And they just didn't, quite frankly, care about a lot of their core service delivery functions. I wanted to comment on Ngebo Faku, who, I mean, I think as you can hear from both Mkabisi and myself, he's a fascinating character. And I'd encountered him when he was serving as mayor in his first term and really fell in love with him. I thought, here's a clear, strong-minded, strong-willed mayor with a vision for what he wants to do with the city, and he's getting things done. And, you know, I suppose similarly to some of the provincial leadership, I was prepared to turn a blind eye to some of his more autocratic tendencies. The big change that I saw was when he stood down as mayor, but he retained the role of regional chair. And what two things happened. The one is that he developed business interests. So he went in, he had a construction company. He was setting up a whole lot of different things. But he also got used to giving instructions from the ANC regional office. And it became the classic case of the municipality and core administrative and operational decisions being made in the ANC's offices and then simply passed down as instructions to, you know, the apparatchiks employed in the municipality. And Ngebo found over time that, you know, if the mayoral committee members didn't do what he wanted, he simply called the officials directly and gave them instructions. And I think that's when things really started to fall apart.
Can I play devil's advocate here, if you don't mind? So this is how I understand the large arguments that are being developed here. There are various interests, class interests, group interests, social groups. They joined the ANC, perhaps in good faith initially, but soon realized that the ANC is the route into various forms of accumulation by the ability of the ANC to appoint them to key positions in government. They then use that relationship to accumulate or to loot or to take or to steal large resources of within the state to enrich themselves. There may be a little bit of political goodwill involved in the process, but largely this is a process of what Carl von Holt once called class elite accumulation. So is that largely the argument? Because if it is the argument, what surprises me is the short-sightedness of this particular group of people. Because it seems to be that very, very quickly, in a very, very short space of time, if this is what they're doing, they wreck the very apparatus which they need in order to accumulate. It's very, very quickly that the institution of the municipality goes into fundamental crisis, in which the kinds of resources which might have been available in the past are suddenly not so much available now, or they create a situation of such intense and violent competition that not only are their livelihoods at risk, but their very lives are at risk. This seems to be a political way of operating which is so short-sighted and dysfunctional that one kind of wondering if these people are not somehow crazy.
Well, it's not entirely that. It's also apart from livelihoods, business interests, it also has to do with self-protection, avoiding going to prison. Because they, you know, the Pikoli, firstly, the Kabuso audit report that reveals all sorts of corruption when Nceba was implicated. The Pikoli report does the same thing. So you have folks here who think that the only way they can avoid going to prison, obviously, firstly, is to make sure that the charges don't make it to the authorities, you don't have a case and all that. But they are only able to do that, try to destroy evidence and mess with witnesses. You can only do that if you are still in charge of the municipality. So at some level, it becomes an issue of self-protection, not to go to prison. So because the stakes are quite high. And added to that is the lure of money is not just about for self-interest, for your own livelihood, but it's also about getting elected. Because the ANC itself is corrupted. The party's electoral processes are corrupted. Branches are no longer really genuine branches. You buy branches. The possibility of profiting from office makes office so important that you are willing to do anything to get into it, including creating your own branches, buying people. So you need money for that entire infrastructure. I mean, it's amazing that if you go to PE or any other township before conference, either regional, provincial, or even national, you'll see how much money is injected into the local economies. Everyone has money. They have phones, they have cars, everyone is drinking fancy whiskey, you know, because of monies that primarily come from government to finance these campaigns. And then you asked earlier, Ivo, how then do you stop it? Why is it allowed to continue? And this relates to the question that Toby asked earlier, that this is commonplace throughout. It's because these factions, which have now coalesced around financial interest, cut across geography, right? It's local, provincial, as well as national. In PE, the Kupe guys, Kupe was a regional secretary from 2008, responsible for the corruption, massive corruption there. Was in alliance with Oscar Mabuyane, who's now the chairperson and premier. And Mabuyane was in alliance with Gwede Mantashe. The evidence of this, you see, when Zanu-Xolo Wayile becomes mayor in 2010, who was part of that faction but got tired of it and wanted to clean up things as part of COSATU realizing that they needed to do things differently. So Zanuxolo Wayile gets into this campaign to fight out corruption, and then they want to get rid of him. And guess who is in the forefront to get rid of Wayile? It's Oscar Mabuyane. They frustrated Derek Hanekom, who was an NEC employee there trying to make peace. And Mabuyane was in the forefront to get rid of Wayile, mainly because Wayile wanted to act on the Pikoli and the Kobuso reports. And then if you're looking for evidence of Mandasha's involvement there, you fast forward to 2014 when, you know, things had really declined. It was a mess, a serious mess. So you have a coalition, a civil society coalition mobilizing a government outside the Eastern Cape to intervene. They write to all sorts of people to whoever cared to listen. And part of the reason why they were appealing to everybody else was because the SG's office, where Mantashe, was unresponsive to their pleas to intervene. It took JZ, actually. JZ took the initiative to disband the Kupe Regional Executive Committee in 2014 because Mantashe was just downright uninterested because it was his faction that was messing up in PE. So you have an alliance, right, that cuts across regions. So structures that are meant to exercise oversight over the, you know, that these structures lower down who are doing the wrong things, are themselves implicated. They are part of that mess. That is why today in PE, Andile Lungisa, who's been convicted, whom everyone says is bad news, and the PEC has been saying he must withdraw as an MMC, has refused to step down. Because he is supported by Ace Magashule. Ace Magashule and Andile are pretty much part of the same WhatsApp group, right? So these alliances, Ivo, you know, so it's not just one part of the organization that has gone rotten. It's the entire organization. It has become a cartel. You know, each person has something on the other person.
This is pretty bleak stuff. And I'm thinking now from the perspective that, you know, objectively speaking, South Africa is in a very deep and fundamental crisis. I think some people have even called it existential, both economically, socially, medically. COVID has raised and has brought to the surface the deep malaise in all sorts of areas of government and the state. It seems going forward, we need to somehow be able to operate what you call programmatically. In other words, we need to be able to reach consensus around certain kind of developmental plans, economic plans, and we need to be able to implement them. From what I'm hearing from you and also from Crispian is that the degree of contestation within the ANC as the dominant party means that all this planning is kind of pipe dreams. And that the likelihood is that any attempt to try and operate programmatically is going to result in this kind of very fierce and dysfunctional contestation, which leaves South Africa in a rather terrifying place. Is that essentially what you're saying? And if it is, then, yeah, well, is that what you're saying? Or is there a way out of this mess? For both of you, for Crispin and for you, and for Morisi.
Just to comment on the contestation, the sort of traditional narrative has been that the ANC is too dominant, that it runs these programs from their regional and provincial offices, and it's seen as a problem of too much power. I think it's a problem of too little power and too fractured an organization. So any leader that's in power in the ANC knows that there's another 100 aspirant leaders jostling to get where they are. And they're forced into ever shorter term calculations. I've got a slightly elastic approach to the way rents get used. I'm not opposed to using the state using certain rents to actively build a new black industrial bourgeoisie. I think, you know, most of the successful developmental states across the developing world have used rents generated by the state to advantage new claimants and rights holders. But the successful ones are able to demand performance from the new classes that these rents are being allocated to. And to be able to demand performance, and if someone's not performing, take rents away and give it to someone else, you've got to be strong. You need a level of authority and power in relation to those aspirants. And I think the ANC is a weak organization. I think it's fractured. It's been provincialized and regionalized. And all the way down into branches, it's this constant churn of factions wanting to get their turn at the trough. So it's unable to craft and lead a developmental program. It's unable to use the advantages that the state can create for black business in a progressive, you know, proper way. And instead it becomes a sort of inward feeding frenzy that's been called clientelism by some academics.
Yes. I mean, there isn't a shared vision. I agree there partly with Chippy. There isn't a shared vision. And I mean, the ANC is devoid pretty much of any strong moral figures. And so it's difficult to get one person, a good guy, around whom everyone can coalesce, because most of the good guys have been driven out. It's difficult to remain a good guy in the ANC because you have to withstand all the attacks, and it's heavy. It requires a serious heavy lifting. So a lot of veterans, good guys have decided to go into the Veterans League. They are outside of the party now. And of course they have families. So life has, you know, assumed its own thing as well, of course. And so you are left with these guys who are quite brave, very energetic young guys, and they don't think twice about stealing government money. And so how do you, can you come out of it? If you can you have to get rid of the other guys pretty much. And the only way you do that, I don't think the ANC itself, they are fond of saying you can self-correct. No, that's nonsense. You need law enforcement. That's the only thing that can help the ANC. Because the criminal elements are right in there now, right? Lungisa is supported by a militia in PE that threatens everybody. And so, you know, if you are to stand up and challenge him, you run the risk of being assassinated. So the only way you cripple that faction, that criminal faction, is if it's taken care by the law. But the ANC on its own is going to be challenging to self-correct. It needs serious impetus from outside. But not, you won't find it from within.
So what's been so interesting about today's show is that we've had two accounts, one from a seasoned activist, part of the team, an ANC team that went into Port Elizabeth to try and help clean it up, first-hand account of that experience, and the second, a more academic, disinterested view of that politics, but coming up with very similar sorts of issues, similar sorts of issues arising from their experience and from their analysis. So the first one is the level of competition and violence and factionalism within the ANC. The second one is the degree to which that factionalism infects the government of Port Elizabeth. Now, in South Africa today, what I find disturbing is that we take that symmetry between the factionalism of the ANC and the factionalism inside government as a kind of given. But the problem is there's no automatic follow through, that the factionalism in the one place leads to factionalism in the other. In most places in the world, and including in parts in South Africa, party politics is insulated from what happens in government. So you can have a factionalized party, but that doesn't necessarily mean that factionalism plays out in the administration. So the question is, why has that happened in South Africa? So this is one of the key questions which we need to explore in South Africa, because it's understanding that relationship that really helps us understand a state capture, but generally the state of corruption in our administrations. I think from the podcast we've learned, for example, that one of the ANC's policies is around deployment of party political officials into administrations as officials, and that's definitely one of the conduits which allows for the politicization of these kinds of administrations in the kind of factionalized ways which we've heard today. And it does seem to suggest that going forward, this is one of the key areas we need to tackle.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a really fascinating, strong debate about the deeper issues affecting South African politics and government. Thank you for listening to this Filling the Gap podcast. Please subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share this on social media.